Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidelia. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas,
California. It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey, for getting us on the air one more time. Approaching 4 years, about mid-November, I think it will be 4 years we've been doing the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I was having a little discussion here with Emily before we got started, and she wants to know if I'm going to use one of these energy-saving tips that was in the news, and I think I am. I mean, this is important. It's an important discovery. Something is going on in Great Britain, and I think we can all probably look forward to it, and I'll just leave you in suspense there for a moment till we get to that. But ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network, the Jumble Justice Radio Show, the network that has thousands of shows, a show or two or three for everyone's liking. And you look around on Blog Talk Radio Network, you'll find something that you like. I'm your host, Keith Haley. I want to thank Johnny Cash again for taking us on that marvelous trip across the United States. He visits 90 cities and states in that song, I've Been Everywhere, Man. He has just about been everywhere, and I think he's probably still traveling. Emily, Mike, thank you very much for joining us tonight. And Emily, I don't want to offend you with this energy-saving story, but, okay, you won't be. Thank you very much. The purpose of the show, ladies and gentlemen, is to discuss news, issues, events, developments, other kinds of things, and the difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice, and we'll have some examples of that tonight. Our show is dedicated to the tireless police, courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and around the world. We look inside criminal justice and take a real close-up look at its practice, and tonight is going to be a good example of that because we're going to get a chance to hear from a gentleman that's been a police chief in two major cities in the United States and the deputy police commissioner and spent most of his career with the New York City Police Department. Born in Dublin, Ireland, John Timoney, I think you'll find him very interesting as he discusses in the city of Philadelphia, where he was once the police chief, what goes on relative to crime and enforcement and fair policing and all kinds of issues. So I think you'll enjoy it. You're listening on the Blog Talk Radio Network. It's a leading edge technology still. Alan Levy is the CEO of BTR, and he's the genius behind the medium, as I'm fond of saying. And what is possible for anybody, you can have a interest group, you can be an individual, you can have a group or an organization. And what you can do is you can broadcast live in streaming audio over the Internet to an unlimited number of listeners. You're broadcasting worldwide We have people that we know listen overseas, and you can do that absolutely free. And who knows how many hours a week you can broadcast now. I think I saw somebody on there was on every day, but I don't know, maybe an hour a day. I'm not sure. I think you can do it. But just imagine that. If someone would wake up from 100 years ago, they would not believe it. Our shows are archived immediately, and some people actually listen to them through archiving. And you can download them and replay them or store them MP3 format. There you go. You can lose your life on Blog Talk Radio by scouting around and looking at all of those shows. So I mentioned tonight we're going to be talking about what it's like to be our guest host through BookTV.org. He's going to be talking about what it's like to be a police chief, police commissioner in a major city in the United States, and he's done that. Well, he wasn't the commissioner in New York City, but he was close. Deputy Commissioner, and he was a chief in Miami, Florida, and also Philadelphia. So it's going to be interesting to see what he has to say. And he's an insightful person, a man with a lot of energy, and I think you'll enjoy listening to him. Now, you can listen on the computer or with Windows Media Player, some other type of player. You can call in by phone, landline, Skype, whatever you use. You can hear the whole show on the phone. And the number you use to call in if you want to call during the news segment of the show is 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. And should it ever happen, as in the past, we can hold five calls at the same time. Again, you can play all those shows back if you want to do it. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if you would happen to be tuning in for the first time, Audrey, our spiritual and technical advisor for the show, she has been a collector of blonde jokes. She is a blonde herself since a small child. And she has a blonde joke for us tonight that I think most folks will enjoy. We do a blonde joke every week, and we've been doing it for almost 4 years now. So, Audrey, go ahead with your joke. Let's see what you got.
Professor Haley, the blonde joke for tonight involves three ladies we have become very familiar with. I think you will recognize them as the girls are out on the town. Here is the joke. There is legend that goes like this: in a bar in New York, there's a magical mirror. If you go up to it and tell it the truth, it will grant you one wish. But if you lie, poof, it swallows you up for eternity. A brunette, redhead, and a blonde walk into that very bar with a real purpose. They head straight for the magic mirror. The redhead goes first and says, "I think I'm the most beautiful woman on earth, boof." The mirror swallows her up, and she's gone for eternity. The brunette goes up to the mirror and says, "I think I'm the sexiest woman on earth, boof. Now she's gone too." Lastly, the blonde goes up to the mirror and says, quote, "I think," poof.
The blonde didn't even get to get out about what she was thinking about because the mirror detected blondes don't think. All right, very good. Thank you, Audrey. That's one of my favorites. It's a good one. Ladies and gentlemen, on a much more serious note, the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence has a public service announcement that they would like all criminals to hear, and we play it every week in the interest of protecting the community. And we're going to go ahead and play that public service announcement now. And I think it's directed toward the criminals on the street, that if they can hear this message and see how serious the Ohio Coalition is, they will get down and turn in their firearms. We have some firearm stories tonight in the news, so I'll mention that later on.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition, and it certainly is a deadly matter. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have our usual green tip in the interest of planet sustainability, and who knows how dire the situation is getting as we move day by day closer to possible extinction because of global warming. We've been giving a tip for years, and we've been working off of Esma Floyd's little book entitled 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. Now, this one tonight is a very important energy-saving tip, and I think all, I'm going to give people time, I should give them time to write this down, this important tip from Esma Floyd's book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. And I just heard Al Gore speaking again last week somewhere, and he's talking about what dire straits we're in. I don't think everyone's catching on to it. We're anticipating some of the coldest winters on the planet upcoming this particular winter, but, you know, there's flukes and everything. All right, here's the tip. Is everyone ready to copy? It has to do with shutting the door. The tip here from Esma Floyd, page 61, tip number 253, is close the door when you're having a bath to trap the heat in the room and stop the water from cooling down too fast. Otherwise, you could be tempted to add more hot water. Of course, as you add more hot water, you're using your hot water heater, you're burning more energy. So there it is, ladies and gentlemen, something that you probably never thought of, that when you're taking a bath in the bathroom, you have the tub full and it's got hot water, be sure the door to the bathroom is closed. What do you mean, Mike? You always close the door. Well, this apparently is directed to those people who don't close the door while they're taking a bath. Now, that could be, well, I won't even comment. But anyway, there you are. What an energy tip. I mean, that's really something. And I'm going to remember that one from now on, is keep that door closed while you're taking a bath, because you'll be saving energy. You might have other uses too, but anyway, let's take a look at some criminal justice news. And you know how one of my favorite national political celebs to comment on is Bloomberg in New York. Well, he's out and about again. And if I can get my news stories up here, we'll talk about it. And what Mayor Bloomberg is wanting to do, I can get the story pulled up. Where is it? Mayor Bloomberg is recommending, and he's sent this up to the state. The state's endorsing it, too. If I can get it up there. It's thinking. Here we are. Mayor Michael R. Bloomberg, who some people think is actually considering running for president of the United States, and then I saw a story last week that they might consider him in a top financial advisory position in the Obama administration. But Mayor Bloomberg sought federal permission on Wednesday to bar New York City's 1.7 million recipients of food stamps from using them to buy soda or other sugar drinks. Now, isn't that something? The request made to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which finances and sets the rules for food stamp programs, everybody knows that, is part of an aggressive anti-obesity push by the mayor that has also included advertisements, stricter rules on food sold in schools, and an unsuccessful attempt to have the state impose a tax on the sugar drinks. Public health officially, they greeted Mayor Bloomberg's proposal cautiously. Some are saying it's a good idea. Some are saying it will be discriminatory toward the poor of the nation by singling them out and allowing them, or not permitting them, to have sugar drinks off of the money they get. Here's what Mr. Hacker says, one of the senior policy advisors for Health Promotion Project of the Center for Science and the Public Interest. He said, the world would be better, I think, if people limited their purchase of sugar beverages. Mr. Hacker said, however, there are a great many ethical reasons to consider why one would not want to why we would want to stigmatize people just on food stamps. The mayor requested a ban for 2 years to study whether or not it would have a positive impact on health. And I guess at the end of the 2 years, I mean, he'd weigh the whole city. Would that be the idea, Audrey? He must be scales maybe on the corner or something where everybody could sort of check in and weigh. But anyway, in spite of the great gains we've made over the past, he says, we're still losing the battle of obesity and diabetes. And this will give New York families more money to spend on food and drinks that provide real nourishment. And I what are those, some of those drinks? I don't think I drink them. What is it, like carrot juice and celery and, you know, what would that be, like corn juice? Is there such a thing? Well, there's corn liquor. No, can't bring that up. But anyway, he's going to do that. He's just as serious as can be. And the state health commissioner, he said the ban would not reduce the ability of food stamp recipients to feed their families because they still have all their money to spend from food stamps on, regular food, whatever that is. But he's also expanding the city's smoking ban. He's very healthy on that. He's stopped that to ban almost all indoor public places, and he's proposing to expand it to beaches, parks, and plazas. Anyway, sugary drinks, look out, save the Cokes, I've got a button, and people will be fighting mad all over the country if Coke eventually gets banned. Minnesota's sought its ban also. Welfare rights advocates, they're accused the state of being patronizing to food stamp users. Don't know exactly what that means, but over the past 30 years, the consumption of soda and other sugary drinks in the United States had more than doubled. I think the population's gone up too, hasn't it? I think it has. Okay, there you go. You got to be careful about some of these stats. But on Wednesday, Mayor Bloomberg, one of the food stamp users, Marangeli Reyes, 24 of Harlem, said the mayor should not dictate what food she bought. And then she emerged from a shop. She had a 20-ounce bottle of Orange Crush. She says she drinks at least one a day. But after giving it some thought, she said, well, I probably shouldn't be drinking that much. They actually had a figure here. They're saying that if you drink one little bottle has 150 calories, and if you don't drink one of those a day, then you're going to lose, how many pounds is it a year? It's like 23 pounds or something like that. I mean, that could get dire if you keep doing that. I mean, you could lose 23 pounds a year. You could be down to nothing in no time. But anyway, isn't it interesting that we're wanting to do that? Well, you know, here's another really interesting story out of England. And I love the British. You know, they were leaders in development along with the Japanese and computers and all that. But here's what they're doing in England. Human waste is being turned into renewable gas and used to power homes for the first time. Isn't that a great story? A pilot project by Centrica and a plant Didcot Sewage Works, Oxfordshire, is the first in Britain to produce renewable gas from sewage for households. The waste is stored for 18 days and then turned into domestic gas. And what a story. The scheme seems sewage arriving at Didcot, it works for treatment, and then sludge, the solid part of waste, is further turned and treated in a process known as anaerobic digestion, in which bacteria break down the biodegradable material, and then it creates gas. I won't go over that again, but sounds scientific. The gas is cleaned before it is fed into the gas grid, and then that gas is pumped right back into the home, and it will power people's houses for you know all sorts of things. It says the gas is cleaned before it's fed to the gas grid, in a process which takes around 20 days. From the lavatory flush, from the time you flush your toilet, to being piped back into your house. Isn't that absolutely incredible? And this anaerobic digestion, it's already used to create renewable energy from sewage. But this is the first time that's ever going to be pumped directly back into people's homes. I'm excited about it. Energy experts believe that 15% of all gas consumed could come from, 15% of all of our use of gas could come from human waste. Now, I've got a dilemma here. If we're getting skinnier, and they want everybody skinnier, not going to eat as much, I don't want to get too technical about this, but does that mean you probably have less waste, so therefore we'd have less energy coming back to the house, and then we'd have to go out and have energy the other ways, coal, or cut down trees and burn wood, or, you know, whatever. So, you know, who's keeping the big calculator in the sky to say which way is best, but look for this coming. I mean, it sounds like human waste is going to be the next, the next big thing, but absolutely incredible. I think Al Gore probably likes it. I'm sure he's probably using one of these laboratory devices himself already, wouldn't you think? Now, you think that isn't something. Don't you love England? They're topping that. Everybody goes out and walks their dog, right? Your dog has waste. Now you can pick up your dog and go to corners. And some places are calling this the park spark. But dog owners know their best friends are going to have to go no matter what. Now they can turn that into energy by putting it into a device called the park spark. Drop it in, turn a wheel. In fact, there's even a picture of it in this news story from Great Britain. And the methane from the waste powers a gas light style streetliner. Isn't that incredible? So now you can go out and walk your dog and light the streets. More dog walking, more dog eating. Well, I guess, yeah, you'd have to have your dogs make sure they eat a healthy diet. And it just goes on and on. I just can't quite believe all this going on. You ever heard of this pizza scam? This is a story that was going on that I forget where it took place in the United States, but somebody orders a nice big pizza or two, and they come to the house, and a little girl runs out in front when the pizza guy gets there and says, "My mom's in the shower. She'll be out to pay in just a minute." So he gives the pizza to the little girl, and she runs around the house, and it's all done. And then the guy waits out front, and then he finally figures out that the little girl don't even live there. That's just a way that they get the pizza. Mom is not in the... His mom is not taking a bath, but boy, I'd hate to be a pizza delivery person, wouldn't you? That must be one of the toughest jobs in the world. Here's a story that's kind of involved, but it's an interesting one. You know, we didn't have CCW laws, and crime was high, and people were afraid of guns, and finally the climate shifted where people needed firearms to protect themselves, and finally we got every state but two that allows people to go through some type of process and then get a concealed carry license. And we know, you've heard me say it many times, 1.5 to 2 million people a year use a firearm to ward off a felon. Most of that, 97% of the time, that means they pull it out, the felon sees it, and they take off. Well, the next step in this is already occurring. Talk about Nashville. Tennessee is one of four states that is now permitting CCW holders to not only take their firearm in a place that serves alcohol, like, what's another one, Applebee's or someplace like that. I think they serve alcohol. But now they're allowing you to actually take them into bars, a place that doesn't specialize in food. More than 50% of profits come from alcohol. Texas, you can carry in any place as long as more than 50% of the profit doesn't come from alcohol. In other words, you could be sitting, it says right here, in the city strip of honky-tonks. This is Nashville, just down from the Grand Ole Opry. They said that you can carry your 9mm pistol, whatever, and you're right in there. And we'll see what happens with that. And he says, you know, if someone's sticking a gun in my face, I'm not relying on charity to keep me alive. That's a good thing. You shouldn't rely on charity. Some people are against it. Another guy says, you know, I don't want people being Wyatt Earp inside of my bar. But Tennessee's one of four states, Arizona, Georgia, Virginia, and Tennessee, the recently enacted laws explicitly allowing loaded guns in bars. But can you believe this? I didn't even realize this. There are some states that, due to the absence of talking about this particular thing, it may be legal to carry. And guess what? New York is one of those. If you have a permit in New York, it doesn't say that you can't carry. Very difficult to get, by the way. Almost impossible. It's only probably the well-to-do and those with a dire need for protection. But anyway, it's kind of interesting to see whether this catches on nationwide. And again, it's not our concealed carry license holder that's our problem. It's the burglars and thieves and robbers, home invasion types, rapists that is the problem. Anyway, we'll have to see whether this thing goes on and transposes across the United States. Well, let's do one more news story before we shift to our feature part of the program tonight. And I think I'm going to talk about this one on deportation. You know that illegal immigration and ways to stop it is one of my favorite subjects. Well, here's what's happened. It was just announced yesterday that the immigration authorities deported a record number, 392,862 immigrants over the last year. That's what Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano said Wednesday, that was yesterday, about half of those deported, 195,772, these are convicted criminals. She says also a record. Ms. Napolitano said an increase of more than 81,000 deportations of criminals over the final year of George Bush. Oh, they always have to bring up George Bush. And the writer here in the paper, this is the New York Times story, yes, he is not suspect. He does mention that midterm elections are approaching and people are a little mad about the lack of apparent concern for the government with illegal immigration. Now, in fairness to them, we are working on it, but I don't think we're working on it real hard, relatively speaking. But the Obama administration would like to have a nice record during the midterm elections to say that they're doing something at a record pace to stop illegal immigration in the United States. Now, people are trying to follow up on this figure, by the way, and they're finding out that they can't, that the data is sort of locked and you can't go in and check it. Normally it's not, apparently. But smarter enforcement is working. So researchers who study federal statistics say they could not dig into the immigration figures to learn more about the deportees who weren't criminals because immigration authorities had blocked them for the first time from receiving detailed kinds of data. So it'd be interesting to see you know, what the data actually say. You've heard about some of the mistakes we've been making with employment figures and unemployment figures and jobs created and jobs lost, that type of thing. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes on. Well, we're going to switch now to our presentation, and what you're going to hear is John Timoney, and again, he was a long time, born in Dublin, Ireland, by the way, immigrated to the United States with family, and he became a New York City police officer, and then worked his way up through the ranks over many years, became a deputy commissioner in New York City, left there, became chief of police in Philadelphia, and then after Philadelphia went on to Miami. So it's rare that somebody would have that type of CEO position in three different cities. So I think you'll enjoy listening to him. Give me a minute to get it set up, and away we go with John Timoney. That's T-I-M-O-N-E-N-E-Y.
Timoney's chronicle of his life in law enforcement. His story covers him as a beat cop in the South Bronx, lowering crime as police commissioner in Philadelphia, and becoming Miami's police chief. The Philadelphia Free Library hosts this hour-long event, the program some might find offensive.
Well, good evening, and thank you all for coming. And let me begin by thanking Library and the folks at Penn Press for putting it together. It's interesting, I've served in three cities, and I think it's only fitting to kick off this book tour in the city of Philadelphia. Even though I spent a lot more time in New York, obviously, Philadelphia and Ed Rendell really gave me my start. Peter asked me, really at the opening line of the book, but you always want to be a cop. And most chiefs will tell you, yes, from the time I was in grade school, that's all I ever wanted to be. And not in my case. I did not like police officers growing up in Washington Heights. As a matter of fact, I didn't like it when I was growing up in Dublin, Ireland, before I came to Washington Heights in 1951. They were like parents and teachers. They told you all the things you couldn't do. They arbitrarily took stickball bats from you on 175th Street, just because this lemon drop was complaining that we were hitting the spore beans against her window. And so, didn't like police officers. However, a group of friends of mine that I grew up with, went to high school with, all took the police officers exam in 1967 and entered in March to the NYPD. And while I didn't like being a police officer within 3-4 weeks at the most, that began what is up to this time, a 40-year love affair with a profession that not only have I come to love, admire, and brag about, but I've also been fortunate to live through some tumultuous times and seeing the process of change over those 40 years. I won't go into detail in the last chapter of the book, but it may be, from my opinion, the most important chapter. I'll leave it up to you to read it, but it's a chapter on race and policing. There are three sections of the book, obviously New York, Philadelphia, and Miami, but the issue of race and race and policing, you know, covers not just those three cities, but every city in America. And when you look back, when I came on as a young man in 1967, in the NYPD was a majority male, white organization. And to see the transition over the next 30 or 40 years, not just in that department, but in departments across America, not, by the way, not willingly, but being pushed, shoved, and sometimes sued as a result of the grievances coming out of the 60s, the Vietnam protests, civil rights movement, et cetera. And so, my favorite chapter is the last chapter because we've come such a far way. We have integrated police departments all across America. In fact, the Philadelphia Police Department, as far as reflecting the population it serves, is one of the leading departments in that area. And so when you look at the whole issue of integration, it strikes me as ironic that the two most conservative institutions in our society, the police and the military, have made the most progress in integration and getting a well-integrated workforce. When you read more in the chapter concludes, interestingly enough, this year, one was the remarks made by a good friend of mine, Eric Holder. He was telling the truth. But he chose words I probably wouldn't choose. Talked about this being a nation of cowards refusing or unwilling to discuss the issue of race. He took a lot of flack for that. And I had a meeting privately in Washington with him. I told him, you know, you said the right thing. But he took such a beating. We wanted him to speak more on that. Us at the Bleacher Desert Research Forum. And he took a pass. But anyway, fast forward 4 months after that, we had post-racial presidents and a post-racial society get involved in a racial incident referring to the Cambridge Police Department as having acted stupid in the arrest of Professor Gates. And so even the president, who had run a tremendous campaign staying above the fray, even he too got dragged into this issue of race and race in society. Finally, on the comments, it's interesting. When I was going to college in the early 70s. And for whatever reason, I took a weekend to read the book called Democracy in America. It's a fantastic book written by a Frenchman in 1828. And he talks about this new American society and how great it is and all the opportunities. And he goes on and on and talks about how it's structured. And this is the new, if you will, the new nirvana. This is where it's happening. This is what the future looks like. There's one problem, though. He says the Achilles heel, if you will, of American society and the whole issue of race. And how would they deal with the issue of the races, the mixing of the races going forward? He thought pretty prophetically that would be, and of course, it did become an issue certainly into the 20th century. But having been managed, I think, pretty well in the 60s and 70s to today, you wouldn't recognize today what existed 40 years ago. But nonetheless, there's still some place to go. Some more room for improvement, if you will. In any event, it is great to be here in Philadelphia. As I said, Edwin Dell gave me my opportunity back in the beginning of 1998 when he hired me as a police commissioner. His final 3 years And there was no expectation on my part that I would stay more than 2 years. Every mayor has the right to have his own police commissioner. And so my sense was I had a two-year window to institute the reforms I had in mind, and we went about that rather aggressively. There were a whole host of issues, most obvious crime, but also issues of within the department on the reporting of crime. Those of you that are veteran readers of the Philadelphia Inquirer can remember the series of what's gone on. Well, something went on for an eternity, but it actually went on for about a year and a half. They were striving for their fuel supplies. They did, actually did a very good job of uncovering the deficiencies of the Philadelphia Police Department in reporting crime, especially in the area of sexual battery. And it was a tough time, and it's tough to be in an organization that feels like it's under assault. But nonetheless, we moved ahead, and took a great deal of satisfaction in a Newsweek article some years later, titled From National Disgrace to National Model. And while we made lots of changes in the area of deadly physical force and a whole host of things, I think I was most proud of how we went about fixing the sexual battery unit in Philadelphia Police Department and really regaining the confidence of women in this community. Because there were, and the Philadelphia Inquirer outlined them in really graphic fashion, some outrageous cases. In any event, at the end of it, I put together a committee, because even though we've made the changes, and Timoney said he made the changes, therefore the changes were made, that wasn't enough. There were still issues of confidence. And so I established a committee, if you will, made up mostly of lawyers, male and female. And I gave them the power that most committees, oversight committees, wouldn't have, because I thought it was so necessary at the time. And this committee served the function of reviewing the investigations of detectives. And they could say yay or nay. And if they didn't like the investigation or thought some more investigatory steps should be taken, they could bring it to the attention of the commanding officer of the sexual battery unit. And if they weren't satisfied with that, they could take it directly to me. And it's covered at great length in the book. But the reason I mentioned the story, when I got to Philadelphia, I can't tell you about a small town. Almost neighborhoods. And you get to know one. That's going to be a small town. It's like 1.5, 1.6 million people. Well, it is. I was heading down this morning to do NPR, and I'm walking down Chestnut Street this regular morning, and I run into a woman, throwing a blank on her last name, it'll come to you in a second, who has been a woman's advocate who, back then, in 1998, was leading the charge, her and some other women, on reforming the Philadelphia Police Department, and she was a member of that committee that I established. And what often happens in policing, I'm assuming it happens everywhere else, you put together a committee, they meet two or three times, and then it lacks energy, it lacks focus, and it just drifts. But some of the churches formed, the committee is still in session, they still meet, they still do the oversight, and they've actually taken to the next step where they're involved with the Philadelphia Police Department in a really good partnership dealing with the whole issue of domestic violence. And so it was great to see something that was put in place a decade ago, 10 years ago, still up and running and functioning. So fair dues to Tracy and her colleagues. I go this morning, and so I do NPR, and it was like a trip down memory lane. It was fantastic. Lots of great questions, and then there were some people calling in, asking questions. Terrific day. I happen to mention my favorite topic, police unions and the arbitration system here, and going on from that typical Timoney tirade. And so I'm leaving. I'm heading back now up Walnut Street, and I'm making a phone call. I'm going to be on Fox and Friends on Thursday morning, and I'm doing the final adjustment. And I have my feet up, and I'm writing down a phone number. I have my feet up against the wall. And this gentleman, you're Timoney. I look over at this African-American guy with beads. The guy's like a hippie in the 60s. Okay, good. But he's not moving. He's staying there. Timoney, I'm on the phone. I'm going to the guy. I said, how does this guy want to talk to you? It takes another 5 minutes to finish. He says, hey, guy's waiting. God bless him. So I turn around and I shake his hand, and he looks like a throwback to the 60s. Got the beans, got the stuff. He said, I heard you on NPR. Terrific. I said, good deal. He said, I'm one of the arbitrators. I said, don't take it personal. It's only business. Thank you very much. Well, hell, the arbitrators I testified, you know, in three-piece suits. This guy got beads, looking real sharp, about my age. Obviously, he had not left the 60s, or he hasn't left over close to the 60s. But anyway, just a funny story about how small, what a small town this is. The final thing I would like to mention, in the, you all know Eddie Rendell, I love him dearly, and he's, for me, just a great American hero, with a work ethic that nobody can top, with energy that nobody can match, with a temper that nobody wants. And so, when Ed was in his last year, they do, and there may be some lawyers there, one of the requirements for lawyers is they get retrained and recertified, they've got to go to class once a year, once every 2 years. And I happened to be one of the teachers of that class, and so Rendell was there, all the top lawyers, David Cohen, at this session. We had it at some hotel, about 200 or 300 people, and even Ed went to the courses, you know. I think he spent most of his time outside on the cell phone, but nonetheless, he signed in, he attended the courses. At the end of it, that was like October, he was finishing up December 31st, or wherever it was. And so he's like 3 months left, and the people that ran the course are the law department. And at the end of it, the end of the week, they've been going for 5 days, they want to make a special presentation. So I happen to be up on the dais, anyway, with the student solicitor, and they have a few presents ready. So thank them, you know, because they worked in the law department, their fellow lawyers, all this kindred spirit. So I figured Eddie would be appreciative. No, he starts from back here screaming, get rid of those presents! And he barrels his own Eddie can up, over, and he takes it on, and I go, oh, God, here we go. What did we do wrong now? Put the presents away. We still have 3 more months to go. I'm not a lame duck. And he looks at me, John, I'm holding you. Make sure you say, no, I'm not a lame duck. We are working right up to the very end. I said, yes, Mr. Mayor. And he did. He had us. He drove us right up. And as a matter of fact, his last day, he went to a meeting every hour for 24 hours. In typical Ed fashion. I say that only to get me to Miami, where I spent the last 7 years working for Mayor Diaz, a fantastic leader, much in the image of Eddie Rendell, although not as boisterous, probably more shy, more circumspect, but also a lawyer. And Manny was coming up, Mayor Manny was coming up in his last year, and I told him, you've got to use the Rendell model. Then he says, if you allow them to treat you like a lame duck, you're a lame duck. And so he says, you can't allow them to treat you like a lame duck. People are going to start looking, you know, the old expressions in policing. Who's your favorite chief? The next one. You can't allow that to happen in the Merrill campaign, right? And so you need to focus. You need the government to focus in. There may be campaigns going on. But if you're a term-limited mayor in your last year, you need to focus. And so for many years, he was the mayor of Miami, which almost as important. He was also head of the U.S. Conference of Mayors. And we had an election year coming up in 2008. And maybe for the first time under his leadership, we could get the people in Washington to finally start taking a look at an urban agenda. You know, our vision has been taken over to Iraq and Afghanistan, and we kind of lost the focus on urban America. And so Manny was determined to make sure that he got it back on the front burner. And as a result of that, he made sure that the people at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, the staff people, will be working their tails off. And he did. And they, you know, God bless them, I know them all, but the staff people are like other staff people. And the problem with the U.S. Conference of Mayors is that you're only the president for a year. So they're always, who's your favorite U.S. Conference of Mayors president? The next one. So everybody's always looking forward, not getting much done. And Manny was having none of that. He's using the Ed Rendell model. He used it in the city of Miami, but also in the U.S. Captains and Mayors, and was able, with the assistance, it was interesting. There were five broad areas, five broad categories, and I got through them in the book, that mainly wanted to cover. The number one issue being crime, the urban agenda on crime, and the cops program. And we kicked it off, rightfully so, in Philadelphia, where Mayor Michael Nutter hosted that meeting in Center City. Joe Biden showed up. He wasn't the nominated vice president yet. He was coming up as Senator Biden, the former candidate. But he was coming up speaking on behalf of the nominee Barack Obama. And it was interesting, the same invite had been extended to the McCain campaign and some staffers showed up. But in any event, Biden came in with certain promises, and he says these are not wild promises, these are not empty promises, that there was going to be a restoration of funding for the cops office, a reinvigoration of the cops office, and they took office on, I think it was January 10th or January 20th, and 6 weeks later, Joe Biden came down to Miami to hold a press conference with money from Washington for the city of Miami for hiring additional police officers. So in that regard, what Manny Diaz using the Eddie Rendell model of not easing on the gas pedal your final year, not relaxing, but in fact pressing down harder on the gas, not just on the city workers in Miami, but the folks at the U.S. Conference of Mayors, they were able to get the administration not just to listen, but to incorporate their recommendations in five major areas that they come up with. One, obviously the crime one, the whole issue of infrastructure that was headed up by Ed Rendell and Mike Bloomberg, the arts and culture by Vera Gosa, the whole issue of unemployment and jobs and the economy by Dick Daley, and I forget the fifth one, all things green. I forget what city they handled it in. But in any event, it proved that the Rendell model works, that you get criticized for putting pressure on people, but sometimes, especially in government, you need to do it. You need to get people need to be reminded that at the end of the day, you're working for the public, whether it's as a police officer or a teacher or a sanitation worker in the streets or a garbage collector, you work for the people. And politicians and mayors and city administrators need to keep that in mind and keep the pressure off. You'll hear complaints from the unions that there's too much pressure, that in the area of police departments, that there's so much pressure that they're trying to doctor the crime statistics. That charge allegations has been made in city after city as mayors try and deal with the issue of crime and quality of life in a serious fashion. Some mayors back off. My advice is not to back off. So long as you're doing nothing illegal, there is no problem with, I'm not putting pressure or undue pressure, but there's no problem with holding people accountable. When I go to community meetings, when I went to community meetings here in Philadelphia, I was certainly held accountable by the woman who was screaming at me from the audience about drug dealers on the corner and your cops doing nothing, just driving by when we call 911. And so if I'm held under pressure from the general public and from politicians and everybody else that wants to take a whack, and by the way, rightfully so, then so too the police officers and their supervisors need to be held accountable for what they do. I think in Philadelphia we had a fantastic run in the area of crime reduction, with the reduction of police shootings, but also in a better trained police department, a more humane police department. Wasn't perfect, but every day we tried as much as possible to make it better. The final thing, it's interesting. I'm going to be accused of taking a whack at the press again. So I knew I was going to be making certain changes in the Philadelphia Police Department, and I was going to be dependent upon. If I said the changes are happening, it's the tree pulling the forest. We really needed, not as a partner, but as an independent observer, the press out there telling the story, good or bad. Well, I knew it was a good news story. I knew what we were doing was right. I knew the hearts and minds were in the right place. I wasn't worried. And we did in Philadelphia what, even today, I know what the police department had done. Comstock meetings, which were held every Thursday morning at 7 a.m. sharp at the Philadelphia Police Academy, was open to the public and was open to the press. And it worked out actually to our benefit, because by and large, we had the cops doing the right thing, working their tails off, the detectives doing their investigations. And the press was there to report it, and KYW, Tony Hansen, was doing fantastic because he could interview these homicide commanders and robbery commanders on the break, and he'd be able to put out three or four stories over the weekend, all going to, if you will, enhance the public image and the public confidence of the police department. It was an important role for the press. And while I was there, they attended on a regular basis. But then when I left, I said, 7 o'clock in the morning, can't you make it like, I think some of the interest may have waned. It's also, this is not just the press here in Philadelphia, it's across the nation. And for an avid newspaper reader like me, who has on a regular occasion gone fencing, sword fighting with the members of the Fourth Estate, the notion of newspapers no longer existing or going out of existence, it's just troubling. I always look forward to going back to Ireland, Dublin, small city, million people. I've got like 7 papers. I'll get 3 or 4 of them, and I'll go to Bumey's coffee shop on Grafton Street, get my cup of coffee, and just sit down there, read the Irish Times, the Independent. It's interesting. A little city like Dublin can produce 5 or 6 papers on a daily basis. And some of them have a morning and an afternoon edition. It's extraordinary. And then you see a place like Philadelphia, a big city, and other cities down to two that are bankrupt. Places like Seattle losing papers, Pittsburgh losing papers, New York losing papers. It's just a shame. We need the press. We need the press. We despise them sometimes. We're a pain in the neck a lot of times. They always have these information requests. We do need them. They're what keeps us on our toes. And I'm not sure. I'd love to know what it would look like 10, 20 years from now. I'm not sure. I don't think you'll have like Mark Fazzola, Craig McCoy, the Inquirer. You won't have people like that are working the internet somehow bothering you and asking you all sorts of questions. And that's not good. That's not good. I just don't know how it winds up later on. So it's, I'm going to stop there. There's more in the book, but I think where we have a better opportunity is in some of the questions and answers I've asked. I've been told to be brief. I hope I didn't go too long. And my man here is going to direct you all the questions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. The city seems to have backslid a bit in some terrible ways. Number one, I think you're aware of the fact that this city has become the most dangerous in the country to wear the badge, which is totally unacceptable. But number two, in terms of things like oversight and someone looking over the shoulders of the police, because they too are human, if you're aware of the Pulitzer Prize that the Daily News just got before the sale, it reveals a very unsavory episode in the history of the Philadelphia Police Department. But, and I know you don't want to second guess your friend Ramsey, but what would your suggestion be? And the second question is, I know you're on a book tour, but where will you be on June 16th? I was talking to your friends at Finnegan's Wake, and they said they
Well, I'll tell you what, I won't be at Finnegan's Wake. June 16th doesn't ring a bell. In any event, the issue of obviously the 2 women at the Daily News, one of the Pulitzer Prize, for uncovering a pretty nasty police scandal. Sometimes that goes with the business. 5 or 6 years ago, the Washington Post won a Pulitzer Prize investigating the Washington, D.C. Police Department involving police shootings. It kind of, I'll answer your question with just quick remark. Back in the olden days, in 1890, there were some bad articles about the New York City Police Department, and the chief was screaming and crying about the bad articles. And the editor of the local paper was Joseph Pulitzer. And he wanted to know, why did he keep writing bad articles about us all the time? Pulitzer and his gang over there, over the paper was in New York. He said, here's the rule. Give me a bad story about a cop or a good story about a fireman that sells papers every day. Same logic applies, almost being too defensive. The issue here with Commissioner Ramsey, he is one of my best friends. He is in the top two or three police chiefs in America. He's got a proven track record in Chicago. When he took over Washington, D.C., that place was a mess. I mean, he was greeted with situations that I don't think any chief has ever dealt with. They had, in the prior 10 years, by them taking over, 54 police shootings where people were killed, and Biggering finds 27 of the records out of the 54. They were missing 50% of those records, the reason why the Washington Post got to kill them. And so, yeah, there are bad stories, there are bad incidents, but I'm telling you, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better leader, smarter leader than Chuck Ramsey to handle it. And so, you're only here a year and a half, you've got a fantastic job in the area of crime. I think as he goes forward with this department, I know for a fact he's got other plans. This place will just get better and better. But the city is in very, very good hands with him. All the way back. Oh, sorry. I can't say.
Commissioner, may I call you Commissioner, please? Oh, thanks. Commissioner, may I call you Commissioner?
Yes, sir.
I would like to ask you a question. If you had the opportunity, from your own experience, to determine how crime should be handled, how would you handle it? Because crime knows no color, no race, no creed. Crime is a situation that occurs when what I want is more important than what you have. I mean, I can do things untoward because it's to my benefit, not to yours. How would you solve this problem, no matter where you are, no matter what city? In other words, is there a way to put an end to crime, which has actually been something we've already had from man's beginning?
Difficult question, only because crime really is a personal and a very emotional issue.
I think you kindly said it. There's not enough time to answer. There's three major schools of crime causation, classical, positivist, and the critical school. And the positivist school has literally scores of different theories. Classical and critical have many different theories also. So if anyone had a solution to crime, we wouldn't be needing police departments, and we wouldn't have locks on our doors, firearms in our possession, et cetera, et cetera. I hope you enjoyed that little bit. It was a little bit abstract. I think the commissioner in other settings I've heard him speak is a little more direct, but perhaps he wasn't used to this type of venue at the library and talking that way. But anyway, look on the billing for next week and see what we've got coming up. And we're going to have Vera Lynn take us off here this evening. And have a good evening, and we'll see you next week.
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day. He's smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies. drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know? Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was